Support for the show comes from Atlassian. Productivity. It's a word we tend to obsess over. Am I being productive enough? Is my team being productive enough? But how do we even measure productivity when our team might be distributed across the globe, like ours? With 11,000 plus employees around the world, Atlassian knows a thing or two about distributed work. No matter if you're a team of 2 or 2 million, or if you're around the corner or on another continent, Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom keep everyone connected and moving together as one towards shared goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Hey, it's Charlie. Last week, I was at South by Southwest, where I spoke live on stage with Amelia Meath. You've heard her on the show before with her band Sylvan Esso alongside Nick Sanborn. She's also been a guest producer on Switched on Pop, where she interviewed Jeff Tweedy, Maggie Rogers, Barty Strange, and Katie Gavin of Muna about the act of releasing records. I wanted to speak with Amelia again because there's a predominant narrative that everything in music is impossible for musicians today, and I think Amelia's career suggests otherwise. She's an example of how musicians can build their music as a business. It's not to say that there aren't enormous barriers. There are, and we talk about them. I think Amelia is uniquely poised to offer wisdom about navigating these murky musical waters as a label owner of Psychic Hotline, as a studio owner of Betty's in North Carolina, and as an all-around entrepreneur who's made her own way across multiple musical groups, Sylvan Esso, Mountain Men, and the A's. Not only does she offer her experience, but also in the second half of the show, we explore a case study of another artist who has paved a wholly original and largely independent career, David Gray, and his modern classic, Babylon. All right, here's the show. Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
I'm Amelia Meath, also a songwriter.
Okay, so I want to start with some big headlines. These are from the past couple of years. New York Times says that musicians say streaming doesn't pay. Can the industry change? Stereo Gum says, why are musicians expected to be miserable on tour just to break even? The Guardian, the music industry's over-reliance on TikTok shows how lazy it has become. So clearly there's a lot of issues facing artists today, particularly independent musicians. Many of these forces are, of course, way bigger than any one person. But I want to see how you've tackled some of these issues, like streaming and recording and touring and the issue of monopolistic platforms who suddenly take down all of your music. Let's start with streaming and really ownership of music. Why did you want to own a label and start Psychic Hotline? Does it enable you to do things differently than being on another label?
So one of the reasons why we started Psychic Hotline was very practical, in that we got the masters back to our first record and didn't want to give it to another label. So we were like, we're going to keep this and figure out how to distribute it ourselves.
So you had a deal that at some point the recordings reverted back to you.
Indeed. Yeah. Also, we wanted to figure out a way in general to bring the music that we loved into the world in a way that a lot of the stuff that I like, I find just doesn't really see the light of day or isn't talked about in a way that I think that it should be in order to get other people to love it. And so when we started talking about Psychic Hotline, we started talking about how do we create an environment where the artist is understood and where we can truly listen to them, consider what they're saying, and try to give the gift of the music that they make to the world in a way that doesn't feel like you're waving a little tiny flag and then putting it away immediately.
Okay, so there's a practical reason you get to own your recordings, which I feel like the public is well aware through the guidance of Taylor Swift on the importance of owning one's recordings.
Indeed.
It's nice that you don't have to go back and re-record all of them in order to have ownership of your music.
It's true.
Yeah. And then there's also the creative side.
Yes.
Are there other advantages that you find?
If something goes wrong, it was definitely us that did it.
What's gone wrong?
So much. All the time. When you sign on with a label, you like meet 20 really nice humans one time, and then they sort of disappear into the ether, and you're trying to make a music video, and you're talking to like 7 different people who like you kind of remember from that one weird time that you saw them. And we wanted to create an environment where it's always the same people. You always know who you're working with, And if there's a problem, you can get them on the phone.
There's a real place-basedness to your work. You're in North Carolina. You have also started, I don't know what the relationship between the music studio and the label is, but it seems like you have created a real destination for people. Why did you decide to make a studio you call it Betty's?
Indeed. It's named after my partner's grandmother.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, Betty.
Oh, that's really wonderful. But you're pretty far away from the major music hubs of New York, Nashville, Atlanta, Los Angeles. Why set up there? And what does it do in creating that consistent group of people that you spoke about?
I decided to move there for 6 months to finish the first Sylvanesso record. And then that took off and we just went on tour forever. And so all of a sudden, 3 years later, we were like, oh, we live in Durham, North Carolina. And then we needed a studio practically because we kept on, at first we would only work in our house, and working in your house is hard because then you never stop. So we rented like buildings and would build like makeshift studios in them, and that would only last for as long as the lease did. And finally we had made enough money and we realized that we could actually build the dream studio that we wanted to make.
So the practical side on your end, again, as the band, owning parts of these assets means you can record infinitely and you don't have to pay studio time. That's nice.
Indeed.
But what about, you also said, you know, as a label, you want to have a sort of consistent set of people in a place. What does it do for other people who come to your space? What makes it different than working in the other sort of standard studio spaces?
Betty's?
Yeah.
I designed it so that it's really bright inside.
Could you describe the typical music studio?
Oh, usually it feels like a little bat cave. And there's someone in there who's already mad.
There's a lot of red velvet.
There's a lot of red velvet.
I don't know why red velvet
is. It's bachelor energy, dog. Like, it's just like one little guy who lives in there who's made all the decisions.
Studios are all just like man caves.
Yeah.
The data supports it. Annenberg Institute shows that I think 96% of producers, I believe, it's high 90s.
It's true.
Are men. So
yeah, that's just the people who say they're producers, though. You know.
Yeah. Okay. I've called myself a music producer before, so I understand.
I know, me too.
Okay, so you have a bright space.
Oh, yeah, so it's a bright space. It's run by wonderful people.
It seems like there's something special that people are willing to, you know, hop on a plane to North Carolina rather than, you know, if you go to L.A., you can do a dozen sessions in different places.
There's a recording studio on every block there. The thing that we wanted to make was a place that comes with, you know, there's a woods that you can walk in. And there's a nice person there named Anna who will make you delicious food. And it's made by artists. So usually when you go into a studio, at least for me, the first times I did when I had like bought the time, the clock starts and you're immediately thinking about every minute like dollars and cents. And I wanted to figure out a way to just get rid of that, to make a space that's on a sliding scale that welcomes days where you just can't, you don't want to make music. So you can like go frolic in the woods with your friends. Or like hang out in your room and read a book that's on the shelf or make a paella.
You've attracted a lot of people to make this like their own cultural hub. People have literally moved to be closer to this creative community that you're building.
It's true. It's really nice. It's working.
How about when you're not home? Another part of the story of music right now is that touring is just not working. That you're expected to be miserable just to break even. What are some of the things that you've learned having control of your artist career that make it work for you all? In the specifics of like, how can it work in all the forces that are trying to make it challenging?
I don't know if it can work in that like the forces that are trying to make it challenging is capitalism. So
yeah.
I don't know. Is anyone happy right now?
I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to be here.
We have to choose joy.
But in general, I know. But you know, horrors are real.
Okay, so like, what are the barriers that get in your way? Like, what are the things that you have to confront when you're out there that you're just like, oh, this is bugging me?
What are the general hardships of tour? What are the things that make it really hard?
Yeah.
I was looking
from the business perspective specifically. I mean, I understand that, you know,
yeah.
Physically it can be very challenging. But
yeah. I was lucky enough to begin touring before I needed to take care of my body or brain. Because I was 20 years old. Some people need to take care of their brains from the moment they're born. I could just skibble off into the world and do whatever I wanted to do and had the stamina to continue doing it.
Yeah.
So I love touring, and I love the hardship of touring. It's where I feel most comfortable. In terms of the business standpoint of touring, it's very hard. You have to think about trucking and lighting and how you're going to pay everybody a living wage to do this weird job where they hand you a microphone and make sure the sounds sound good in your ears. Or you have to make sure that all the t-shirts cost the right amount, but not too much because then people will get upset. You need to figure out how much to charge for a ticket, even though you don't ever want to charge $60 for a two-hour experience. But if you're going to have these lights or something like that, you must.
Right.
So it's all of those, it's the balancing of all of those things to try to create your artistic vision as well as something that's hopefully profitable.
One of my understandings is that, you know, every person in the chain, capitalism, is trying to take more and more of a cut, right? There's a lot of frustration over the amount of merch cut that Live Nation takes, for example, right? And people saying, I'm not even making a penny off of this merch after all these cuts. So where are the things in the chain that you choose to own versus the things you're willing to hand off to other people and the burden of having to, you know, have this laundry list of things that you have to manage on top of making the music?
At this point, I've pretty much handed off everything to others, but I have direct relationships with all of the people who manage those things. For example, we have a merch manager who talks to the venue. Also, the booking agent negotiates the rate for the merch before the show, and then your merch manager enacts that and makes sure that all of that happens.
You're building a team of people that are in your ecosystem, which is different than being like, I have an agreement with some other entity that I don't really know.
Yeah. I try to touch every aspect of the thing that we do. Usually I don't have the bandwidth to do it in the way that I would like to.
How do you build that culture of trust that, you know, you described like on a music video shoot? People assemble, dissemble, you never know anyone. What do you do to build that culture of trust on tour so that it actually all works and people follow through and do their things?
You just have to hire the people that feel good and that make you feel like they understand who you are and what you're trying to do, which involves a lot of trust on my side too, you know?
Okay, how about on the side that we have no control over, the monopolistic platforms that are deciding when and when we cannot post music?
Oh.
We have very little agency over this.
Indeed.
What do you do to cultivate audience outside of these worlds? It feels like, you know, the headline is basically like, everybody has basically said, do TikTok only, it's the only way you can market yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely an important outlet for sure. What do you do to think about actively cultivating your audience and nurturing them?
I try to have a direct connection with the people who like my music, which is usually formed during live performances. Mm. Social media helps with that some, but honestly, I've never really found a way to authentically be in that without wanting to leave my physical body, never to return again.
Thank you for being honest about that. I feel the same.
If you're lucky enough to have fans, there's an amazing thing that can occur where like an Ouroboros of energy starts happening where you feel as if you're supporting each other. And if you invest in that, because it's really one of the only things in this industry that feels real. Mm. If you invest in that and believe in it and tell the people who are listening to you that you believe in it, there's a pretty magical and amazing thing that can happen where you get to live in the real world together.
Well, who do you observe who you think is particularly good at this? Sometimes it's hard to look at ourselves and say, I feel pretty good about how I'm nurturing this audience of people that love my music. Are there people that you look up to?
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. The nerds are going to love this. The band that we turn to the most when we're like questioning what we're doing is usually Phish. Because yeah, they have been around forever. They essentially invented the wheel of making festivals and touring forever.
They are one of the top touring acts by ticket sales and revenue every single year. And
exactly,
they are completely outside of any sort of mainstream music. I'm sure they have some streaming numbers, but people probably listen to more of their music on Phish's own streaming service or other streaming services that cater to live music.
Oh, absolutely.
So they're their own ecosystem.
They are.
Okay, so case study in Phish. What are the things they do remarkably well? Like, what are some things that you have observed where we got to do some of that?
They do so many incredible things. I think the thing that they do that's the most inspiring to me is that they see what their fans are asking for and then they actually invest in that. For example, Live Phish, which is like an app that they have where they play a show, they upload that show immediately to Live Phish. One, so that people can watch the show in real time if they have subscribed. So like you can just follow a tour from your living room if you want. But they also were responding to the fact that when people were coming to their shows in like the 90s and taping them, instead of being like, don't do that, they like made a taper's section that you
right,
could
right.
be in if you wanted to tape the show.
Following the taping culture of the Grateful Dead that was developed and,
exactly.
and they allowed it as well.
Yeah, but like if that had started happening, like my reaction to that would have been like, no.
Right.
You don't get to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but instead they were like, oh, yes, of course, you like doing this thing.
Right.
Yes.
There is agency amongst the fans and how they engage with the music. Mm-hmm. They kind of deliver it to them how they want to. I mean, now you no longer have to wait for a tape in the mail via cassette. You just could log in the next day.
It's true. Though the tape is so romantic. They should do that again. People would love that.
Is there anything else in their ecosystem that you think they do particularly well?
They've kind of like bumped out their entire touring world where like I think they started like a catering company that they bring with them. They bring people to like outfit their backstage. They're basically a true traveling circus.
Hmm.
In a different way than most other touring bands are. They bring like a little township everywhere they go, which is really inspiring. So they like have their own merch. The company, I believe. They do all that stuff.
Mm, so yeah, very few people are getting as much of a cut in the process.
Indeed.
Right. Hmm. I was recently invited with a press ticket to go see one of their live shows, and I had seen them maybe 15 years before.
And you went to a very special show.
I went to a very special show. I don't know if everyone... We're getting into a very niche conversation now, but they did a famous New Year's set at Madison Square Garden. And I had just gotten in that evening from the holidays. And I was like, oh, I'll show up. That sounds interesting. And it felt like I was, in a certain way, rejoining a cult that I had left 15 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen an audience so engaged in every song choice. Do you think about that? One of the things that happens in this sort of, the thing that the jam scene had figured out really well is the spontaneity of the set becomes reason enough to participate on top of all the community and, you know, the culture that you get invested in. Is there any way that you bring that sort of culture into the thinking about how each show is its own thing to make it worth going to every single possible show along the tour?
We don't really have enough songs. We only have like 50 songs.
You need like two more decades.
You need like 200 songs.
Yeah.
But there is an aspect of that that seems really fun. Because our show is, Sylvanessa's show right now is so theatrical, and there are a lot of like costume change moments and like key lighting things that I don't think I could do an improvisational set in the same way. Though
right.
every song is different every night because of the improvisation that Nick is doing.
Yeah. Could you describe what we see when your bandmate Nick is performing? It's a whole...
Oh, yeah. Sandy brings like a full modular rig on tour. And he recently added his favorite synth, the Juno 6. And
these are instruments that like no normal human would understand what they're doing when you're observing them.
Yeah.
I program synthesizers and I don't know what he's doing.
I know. It's mad so exciting. Level. It is. Yeah. He has a beautiful math brain. And he's like really good at making it musical. The instruments that he brings on tour, it is so hard to make them make the same sound over and over again, night after night. And he's able to do it.
Hmm. Okay, so this is reason to go see. It's like they won't be the same.
No, they won't.
Every night it's going to be, there's chaos in there.
Yeah, he's created the patch kind of like a sandbox. So like the guardrails are there, but all of the musical elements of it are changing constantly.
What about for you? How do you respond to that?
Oh, it's fun. I just get to respond.
Yeah.
So I get to improvise too, but just physically and with my voice, which I suppose is an instrument.
Yeah. And overwhelming, joyous dance. It's one of my favorite things about seeing your shows.
Thanks.
Yeah, a lot of great dance. In preparation for this conversation, I asked you to bring a song that you would consider a modern classic, a song which has had huge cultural importance, but maybe is under-recognized.
Support for the show comes from Atlassian. In an age of distributed work where teams might be spread across time zones, it's time to stop measuring productivity with standards that come from the industrial era. Productivity that leads to more outputs doesn't necessarily mean better results. Instead, companies should focus on the outcomes that teams deliver. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to help keep you all on the same page page from start to finish. With Atlassian Confluence, your team has one single source of truth to document and share knowledge. Atlassian Jira helps cross-functional teams plan, track, and release new work. And Atlassian Loom helps replace meetings and provide context with asynchronous video updates. Atlassian helps power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Which song did you bring for us?
I brought David Gray's Babylon. And if you want it, come and get it. Cry it out loud. The love that I was giving you was never in doubt. Let go.
I think this is a great pick because it is related to independent artists, and he has an amazing career story, which I want to talk about. But why did you want to pick David Gray's Babylon?
Because the record It Comes From White Ladder is just so good. And most people don't... My booking agent threw it on in the car like 7 years ago while we were driving somewhere. And every time I hear, honestly, any song from this record, but... because this one was the one that was on the radio most, it brings me back in time more immediately.
The album White Ladder came out in 1999, and at the turn of the millennium, this song sort of blanketed alternative radio, adult contemporary radio, mainstream radio, and sounded kind of unlike anything else at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. People don't talk about it or reference it, but like the sounds on it have seeped their way into so much of the music that's appearing right now.
Yeah.
So much of the synth choices and the melodic structures. And I was actually looking it up, and on Wikipedia it says that the genre is folktronica.
Folktronica. Now, as someone who has been in folk bands and music that includes a lot of electronic music, how do you feel about that label? All right, well, we'll come back to this. So I spent the last 2 days looking really deeply into the song, and I think it really presages some of the conversation that we're having about the current music economy. It's a song that, in I think a certain way, prefigures your own career. Can we dig into the story of the song?
Please.
Okay, so background is that David Gray is a Brit. He grew up largely in rural Wales, and he was set on becoming a musician from a very early age. He goes to the same art school as John Lennon, forms a band, gets a demo tape out to an A&R. Used to be you have to have tapes and you get them to people who had gatekept this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is in the early 90s. And he gets a small label deal, puts out a really lovely album called A Century Ends in 1993.
And we'll walk down the shoreline one last time together. Feel the wind blow our wandering hearts like a feather.
So that's Shine off A Century Ends. And his early songs earn him huge critical praise. The 60s songwriting legend Joan Baez called his early work, he said that he's the best lyricist since Bob Dylan. A lot to live up to. But he did not get a lot of commercial radio pickup. This is the era of grunge, mind you, not singer-songwriter folk music. So how do you translate an artistic vision when it's artistically off-trend? I called up David Gray yesterday to ask him how he did it.
I just was doing my best. And all I was being told was all the things I needed to be more like Nirvana, more like Britpop, more like this, more like that, add a beat to it, do this, to get on the radio so people could find out about you.
He's being pushed in lots of direction, changed the sound of the music. He puts out an alt-rock-leaning album called Flesh in 1994.
Once you sang your own song, now you're dancing to the same drum. What have you become?
He even gets a major label deal off of Flesh. He makes a third album called Sell, 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 ambitiously stating the goal, puts out 96. And he tours all of these albums endlessly, literally goes knocking on radio station doors. He gets an opportunity to open for Radiohead, does two tours with them. the albums are not commercially viable.
I was soiled goods at that point. I'd had three albums out. The major labels were not interested, and they said as much.
So the labels gave up on David. On his final US tour, it was a total bust. His bus driver literally at one point abandons David and his fellow musicians under the false pretense that the bus had broken down. And so down in the dumps, he basically has to go back home in the late 90s, goes back home to London, builds a small home recording studio with the very last of his money left over from touring to make one last go at it. And one of the songs that he writes is Babylon.
The verses dance around the different hooks and the different lyric ideas in a rhyming scheme.
Only wish that you were here, you know I'm seeing it so clear, I've been afraid.
The chorus lands, the camera turns inward, and it's me singing to myself.
If you want it, come and get it, crying out loud.
I had to get over myself.
Let go your heart, let go your head.
Let go of my head and my heart at the same time.
Babylon.
Really sweet. So
yeah.
After straining to meet all the genre expectations that he's being forced into, he instead has to go without a major studio, using off-the-shelf gear. He gets a computer, a couple of synths, a sampler, some drums that are recorded with just two mics, and ends up creating this hybrid folk and electronica album, with David telling himself to just go out and get it. Like, this is my last go. And so naturally, along with the help of his manager, Rob Holden, he's going to self-release this album. He's spoiled goods, as he says.
So I think we literally pressed up 3,000 copies with our own money. We had this small following, a very intense following in Ireland from the first three records. God bless the Irish. I mean, the success in Ireland built to such levels that we had like 7 or 8 times platinum there.
He had toured Ireland a lot, and that was where the audience was. And so the song spends 6 weeks at number one in Ireland, where it eventually goes 20 times platinum, becomes the best-selling album in the country. And because he's totally independent at this point, he eventually needs more help getting the physical distribution of actual CDs out in the world, partners up with Dave Matthews' upstart label ATO as the first signee in the U.S., selling 2.4 million records. Then Warner re-releases it in Europe, selling 5 million records under a unique deal in which David, like yourself, would get his rights back at some point in the near future. For him, creative control was very important.
It was a real innocent venture. It became less innocent as we kind of suddenly caught a look of ourselves in the mirror that is success and thought, hey, we look kind of good, you know, we've got the look this year, we're it. And then you can see there's a certain point we start to sort of believe in ourselves. It's fucking awful.
He's a lot of fun. This is a once-in-a-lifetime kind of song. Right, I think this is something which is happening to people more and more and more, where there's like a big blow up moment, mm-hmm. and you have to figure out how to seize it. For David, it's a big deal. He gets nominated for Best New Artist at the Grammys on this very grassroots, self-made album. But he was insistent on building it in his own way and skeptical of promises of the big labels, which means he basically had to run the business.
Mm.
There's a lot of burden of responsibility and decision-making, and I've got to pay wages and shit like that. You've got to make all these decisions, and there's a reason why the music business works in the way that it does, which is that, look, here's the Rolls Royce. Here's the big hotel suite. All the champagne you can drink. And here's a load of money to put in the bank. It's like, don't worry about all the other stuff. We'll take care of that.
So he makes the deliberate choice to not take the pretty cars and the hotels and the endless champagne, and instead takes a note from his friend Dave Matthews to build a lasting artist career by owning his own work and doing the hard work of building out the audience, something he believes can still work today for artists.
The ATO model and Dave Matthews model was basically work it, tour it, play it. It was intense. It was backbreaking work. We went round and round and round and round and round and round and round. That was absolutely mad. So I believe there's still a long game to be played.
He's built a very great enterprise running for more than 2 decades. He's got a great touring career, still releasing music through his own label. His latest album, Skellig, is really gorgeous. I highly recommend checking it out.
Oh, that song I'm singing.
feel like David, in this way, sort of presaged the music economy by building his own studio, self-releasing his own music, nurturing his audience in a way that contemporary artists like yourself have done, and pioneering a blend of minimalist folk and electronic music, folktronica, if you will, a sound that he really admires in your own work.
I love the Silvanesso discipline of less is more, always. I love the minimalism and the leaning on the voice and then throwing electronica into the mix.
Wild winter, warm coffee, mom's gone, do you love me?
And on a track like Coffee, they've got all these beautiful sounds, but if you bring big electronic sounds in or a drum beat, suddenly it just sounds massive.
Get up, get down, get up.
So it turns out you have a fan in England. Maybe a collab in the future.
I love you, David.
So I think this is a thing that a lot of artists are going through today, is they might have their moment that blows up on TikTok before TikTok takes their music down because whatever licensing arrangements exist in the background. And then they've got to do something with it. And I think he is a great case study in a time where it wasn't necessarily perceived as something you could pull off. You had to have physical distribution, and he did it, and he made this whole sound that I think in many ways invites the unique blending of music that you all create. How do you feel about David?
Oh my gosh. He's just so cool. The way that he reacted to having such a giant hit at that time and still kept a cool head. Mm-hmm. Also, that I was aware that he had some records from before.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it was his fourth record, which makes so much sense. Also, to learn that Babylon is to himself, I've always felt that that was true, but it was really nice to hear him say it.
Hmm.
Most people just think it's like a classic love song, which he's so good at writing a love song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the fact that it was a love song to himself is really nice.
Isn't that really sweet?
Mm-hmm.
Do you write to yourself?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
In the voice of someone else?
Yeah,
or like another character?
The other guy. Yeah. The other me. Yeah, totally.
Where have we maybe heard that before?
Oh, boy. Like in all of them, probably. Like Die Young, probably.
Mm.
Coffee, maybe. Probably all the new stuff. I'm talking to myself a lot more now.
Can we listen to one of those real quick?
Sure.
I had it all planned out before you met me. Who's gonna leave early and so swiftly? Maybe in a fire or crash off a ravine. People would weep, how tragic, so early. I was gonna die young. Now I gotta wait for you. Now I gotta wait for you.
What were you saying to yourself?
Oh. You know.
I'm sorry.
And that one, in general, like, it's also definitely a love song, but I think I was talking about the realization that perhaps I would stick around because I was enjoying myself.
I'm really happy you're here.
Me too.
It also speaks a bit to what you were saying earlier about the being on tour and your capacity at that point, at the early age, of just not paying attention to health. And what about anything else off of your last record, No Real Sandy? Are you speaking to yourself?
Oh my gosh, in so many. I haven't looked at what the songs are called anymore. Oh, how did you know? That's totally me talking to myself.
Because up on stage we experience an extreme slap delay echo. I can't quite capture the words. Could you share the words with us?
Oh, I was talking about figuring out how to take care of yourself.
Hmm.
Kind of the same thing that you were just talking about, of like looking back and being like, oh, I did a good job of taking care of the small version of me, and now here I am.
My understanding is right now you have slowed down your work a little bit to give yourself a break. You've toured sort of relentlessly for 3 tours in a row.
It's true.
What are the things that you need to do as an artist so that you can recharge and be back out there?
I don't know. I'm trying to, that's like part of my new project right now, is trying to figure it out. Usually I go towards some old school crafts. Right now I'm making a quilt.
That's wonderful.
It's really fun. I've never done it before. It's hard. Doing a lot of cooking. Trying not to put too much pressure on making anything right away. Because usually when I come off tour, the stimulus of tour is so... There's just so much coming at you all the time. That when I come home and the pace of life slows down, I get like real itchy and kind of freaked. And that is usually solved by immediately trying to make something. So I'm trying to just sit in the not making, and instead I make soup.
Make soup.
Yeah. It works.
That's wonderful. Can I tell you one of the things I've found about in looking up other people who have big business empires in music,
yes,
outside of what you'd expect? Kiss has sold $500 million of merch.
I'm not surprised.
They get all that Hot Topic money. They got the Hot Topic money. It's blanketed everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Can we all say thank you to Amelia Meath for joining us live on Switched on Pop at South by Southwest? Switched on Pop is produced by Rihanna Cruz, edited by Art Chung. This week we're engineered by Bill Lance, illustrations by Iris Gottlieb, community management by Abby Barr. Nishat Kurwa is our executive producer. We're a member of the Vox Media Podcast Network and a production of Vulture, which is part of New York Magazine. You can subscribe to New York Magazine at nymag.com/pod. You can find more episodes at switchedonpop.com, all the social media platforms at switchedonpop, and you can get more insights on our episodes and our newsletter, which you can find on our website or in our show notes. We'll be back again on Tuesday, and until then, thanks for listening. Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Whether we're working in or out of the office, every day our teams are reimagining what it means to connect and produce incredible results. Atlassian's remote-friendly software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom helps your team work effectively by connecting your entire organization in one shared digital workspace. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.